The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
To unleash the full power of the federal government in this effort today, I am officially declaring a national emergency. The action I am taking will open up access to up to $50 billion for states and territories and localities in our shared fight against this disease. In furtherance of the order, I'm urging every state to set up emergency operation centers effective immediately. I'm also asking every hospital in this country to activate its emergency preparedness plan.
Without a doubt, we know the headlines are going to get worse. They're not going to be better. This weekend, they'll be really bad, and they'll be worse when we start testing more, which hopefully happens. You want to see higher totals. I hate saying this, because then you know that we're doing more tests. So if you know the headlines will get worse, what is the only question you need to ask? You need to ask, at what point does the market stop reacting every time a negative headline comes out? Only then will you know that we're getting closer to the end, and we are not there.
We are going into a global recession, okay? We are going into a global recession. After what's been happening the last 2 days, we are going to see a spread of economic sudden stops. And the trouble with economic sudden stops, and unless you've worked, which I have, on fragile and failed states, unless you've worked on those countries, you've never seen an economic sudden stop. So the trouble with economic sudden stop is it's not easy to restart an economy. You've got to get people to re-engage. You've got to coordinate the restart. So the economic damage is going to last. That's why I believe that we are going to get a global recession.
Dr. Marty McCary of the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health is with us live tonight. Should this have been done earlier, all of this?
Yeah, look, we're way behind the eight ball. The signs were out there. For 3 months, we've been watching what's happening in China. My team has been talking to doctors in China and more recently, Italy. Look, this virus is following the playbook. It's doing exactly what was predicted. The study out of Harvard 3 weeks ago said that 40 to 70% of the U.S. population could get infected. And yet many of us were seen as alarmists. What is the danger in having a public that's over-prepared and we look back and say it wasn't quite as bad as the projections? This is a playbook that we are watching in Italy. China's not been transparent and Iran has not been transparent, but Italy has been totally transparent. Look at the numbers there. It's probably the best indicator in terms of case fatalities. Look at their hospitals that are overrun, and you will see what will play out in the United States unless there's some miracle.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Well, it's official. The 11-year bull market is over. Key indexes from the Dow to the S&P are down anywhere from 27 to 30% from the market peak reached earlier in February. The Fed injects an unprecedented $1.5 trillion into the financial markets to keep them liquid. To put that in perspective, when we came out of the financial crisis, the Fed started QE1, which was $1.2 trillion, which would be injected into the markets over a year. The Fed just injected $1.5 trillion in a week. And the president, as of this message right now, declares a national state of emergency for the United States. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplavin. Welcome to a special edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Joining me in the first hour will be Richard Dixon from Lowry's. Richard calls what we've seen these last 3 weeks unlike anything he's seen in his career. The question now remains, if a recovery eventually follows, what will it look like? Will it be V-shaped, as in the past when we've had a V-shaped bottom, or will it occur over time? Also joining me on the program will be Mark Chandler. He's calling what we're seeing right now a Minsky moment as we discuss volatility, margin calls, and probably the best dividend yields in a decade. Later on, Ryan Poplava will be joining as he talks about what moved the markets this week. And following the first hour will be a special edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. In the big picture, joining me on the program will be Dr. Maciek Boni. He's an epidemiologist from Penn University. He's an expert on influenza. According to the doctor, the virus is going exponential. Joining me after Dr. Maciek Boni will be Dr. Leslie Sharp. She's an ER doctor on the front lines of the coronavirus. You're going to want to hear what these experts have to say. But before we do that, let's go to Ryan.
Let's get into the full swing of this week's show and what will be remembered as a historic week in the financial markets. U.S. equities had the worst day since 1987 on Thursday, and the week as a whole was the worst performing since the financial crisis of 2008. Central banks around the globe are taking drastic measures to ensure liquidity is readily available as businesses shut down and the economy takes a shut-in approach to minimizing the COVID-19 coronavirus. The outbreak has finally been characterized by the World Health Organization as a pandemic. Here to talk about this week's catalysts that move the markets is Ryan Poplava with the wrap-up report. Ryan, can you tell us about the steps being taken by the Fed to shore up liquidity and what may be in store for us next week at their March policy meeting on Tuesday and Wednesday?
Well, this week, Chris, the New York Fed announced a massive repurchase operation offering about $500 billion in a three-month repo operation on Thursday. And then on Friday, they said another $500 billion in a three-month and another $500 billion in a one-month repo operation for same-day settlements. So injecting just an incredible amount of liquidity all in a single week. Going forward, the three-month and the one-month repo operation will both be offered weekly for remainder of the month while continuing to offer what we have had before, about $175 billion in daily overnight repos and $45 billion in two-week term repos twice a week over the same period. So throwing everything at this thing in the kitchen sink. You know, the goal was to shore up the treasury market by allowing banks to snap up loans without the typical risk-based charges lenders charge each other. The Dow rose immediately about 1,000 points on that news Thursday, eventually settling back down, unfortunately, near the lows on the day. A lot of panic selling on Thursday. I don't think the Fed could have done of anything more than what they did. And we still would have had that reaction and that panic low. Normally, these types of Fed reactions create bottoms in the past, but injecting liquidity won't stop schools and businesses from shutting down for the next few weeks. But next week, as I said, it's widely expected the Fed will be lowering rates again. The Fed fund futures, like we talked about last week, we're pretty much predicting that. Right now, I'm seeing a lot of talk about interest rates heading back down to all the way zero. And based off a lot of research work that New York Fed President John Williams has done, which is gaining a lot of ground at the Fed, it's why wait if you know that you're heading down to zero by doing maybe one or two more cuts? Let's just do it all at once. So right now, there's a lot of speculation the Fed will hit zero next week, Chris.
So judging by the response to the Fed, while bullish for a few minutes, what else do you think investors need to see before they can step in to buy this correction?
Well, actually, I think we started seeing that on Friday, but there's still a lot of unknowns at this point. Bottoms are a process. How deep is this correction going to go? How much is this going to hurt our economy? That's all unknown. Everyone is just throwing numbers out there as far as what they expect earnings to be at the end of this year, but it's anyone's best guess. I think most investors know that even with the V-like bottoms we've had in the past years, Chris, who knows how it's going to play out this time? It really is different, different circumstances. But I think the media has done a good job of identifying the need for a concrete fiscal response to demand destruction. Before this, our economy was bouncing back from the trade wars with manufacturing perking up. But now the forecasts are for a recession, and many investment banks have all downgraded their earnings expectations for the year. Investors are doing what they can to rebalance and de-risk from lofty levels, but the selling on Thursday, to me, indicates some panic selling is occurring. Treasuries have been selling off all week after Monday's rout, and gold is also correcting as well. So those were typical safety havens that there's been some selling. There hasn't been any safe haven other than the dollar this week. But regarding fiscal stimulus, we've been hearing a little bit here and a little bit there. Obviously, it seems like the parties, it's a political year, right? So are they really going to work together? That's what we need to see. We need to see some agreement. You know, there was a big positive thrust early Friday morning, which actually triggered the futures circuit breaker as the New York Times ran an article stating that the House wants to provide 14 days of paid sick leave, unemployment benefits, free virus testing, and a small business tax relief. Not sure what that is. There was another intraday rally on Friday, right about an hour before the close, ahead of a speech that Trump was scheduled to do, declaring a state of emergency, which he did, in fact, a little bit later in the day, still allowing for, I think, another 15 minutes of trading, saying that, you know, state of emergency, which opens up around $50 billion for state aid and 4 million coronavirus tests that will be available next week. After that news, the market carried to the highs on the day, and I think maybe happy to see the White House taking this seriously. Volatile corrections are typically responded to with volatile rallies. The ending rally on Friday was the biggest since 2008.
We know that stocks have corrected almost 9% this week because of liquidity issues in treasuries alone. And increased cases of coronavirus in the U.S., there was also the oil shock on Monday as the markets reacted to Saudi Arabia lowering its price for April delivery by $6 to $8 per barrel and indicated they plan to increase production. Energy stocks were slaughtered on Monday. What do you think about the energy sector here, Ryan?
Well, there's been a lot of concern that the energy sector may have some credit defaults in the high yield space. I was hearing quite a few numbers. I wanted to just verify a lot of this stuff, so I did some research. And in 2015, 42 oil companies filed bankruptcy, according to the law firm Haynes and Boone, which includes around $13.1 billion of debt moved to bankruptcy. So we'll likely see this continue. Chris, you know, I haven't spent a whole lot of time analyzing this area because less than $2 billion of speculative grade debt will mature this year out of $86 billion of debt due to finance or, you know, to repay by 2024, according to that CNBC article I read. You know, we did invest in energy and materials back in 2016 in debt because there were some incredible deals. We were buying some securities at, you know, pennies on the dollar, like 85 cents on the dollar. And I think that opportunity will present itself now, but it's just not an area that I want to dive right back into immediately right now.
So a volatile end to a volatile week in the stock market. We'll continue to watch how the U.S. reacts to businesses, school districts, and sport venues shutting down in the weeks ahead, to social distancing, and then preparing for the spread of the coronavirus itself. Next week, we know the Fed will announce another policy statement on Wednesday, and hopefully we'll continue to hear more concrete steps by the government to step in like they did on Friday. Thank you, Ryan, for always on your analysis this week. Up next, we'll be speaking with Richard Dixon from Lowry Research. Jim Poplava spoke with Gary Schilling this week on FS Insider to get his outlook on the stock market, bonds, oil, and why he thinks we're looking at a pretty serious recession here in the U.S. and why it's likely, according to his view, that we're not going to see a strong bounce back for a very key reason. Here's a clip of what he had to say in his interview with Jim Poplava on FS Insider this week.
Oh, yeah, and there's another interesting aspect of this. I mean, what's happening now is that both supply and demand are declining. People aren't going to work, you're not getting the supply. People aren't spending, you don't get the demand side. But to the extent that people are stocking up, and I'd hate to tell you how many cartons of toilet paper we've got in our basement right now as a result of numerous raids on Costco, but what's going to happen is that people are going to be working down those inventories after this thing is over, which is going to reduce their spending for many more months beyond the end of the coronavirus scare.
As always, if you want to gain access to this and our full lineup of guest experts that we interview 3 days a week on FS Insider through our website or through a podcast app of your choice, all you have to do is go to financialsense.com and click subscribe.
Do you find yourself reacting to market news, selling when you should be buying, and buying when you should be selling? Are you making costly investment mistakes? It's time to take control and develop a plan that keeps your investments centered, no matter what direction the markets take. We can help you protect your investments during market downturns and profit when markets rise. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management to create an investment strategy today. Call 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, it's official. The 11-year run in a bull market is over as of this week. How much further do we have to go? What does it look like for the days ahead? The president is going to declare a state of emergency. But joining us to look at the markets is Richard Dixon from Lowry's Research, a service that has been providing market information well over seven decades. Richard, I want to begin with this premise. We're hearing on the cable television, the bull market is over, describing 20% correction as a bear market. I'd like to get your take on that view.
Well, you know, this 20% has been the standard for decades, I guess, really. And the question has come up a couple times because we had a decline in 2011, which was, for all intents and purposes, 20%. We had a drop just 2 years ago in the third and fourth quarters of 2018, which also was just fractionally short of 20%. So, I mean, the question becomes, if you're at 19.8%, you're not in a bear market, but if you're 20%, you are in a bear market. That seems to be sort of a distinction or a difference without a distinction without a difference. For us, the major factor in determining what the primary trend in the market is a question: did the market top that preceded this decline that's being defined as a bear market show signs of a major market top? If it did, then down 19.5% or 20% or 21% doesn't really matter. It's a bear market. We saw no signs as of the February 19th high in the S&P 500 of a major market top. We probably follow at least half a dozen different indicators. Obviously, the buying power and selling pressure indexes are major indicators of forces of supply and demand, market breadth, highs, percent of stocks above certain, you know, moving averages, weekly moving averages. There's a whole raft of things that we look at tell us that, yes, you are seeing the kinds of deteriorating conditions that traditionally precede a major market top. We saw none as of the February 19th high. There was a small divergence in our operating companies only advanced decline line. There was none in the New York All Issues advanced decline line. The major market tops that we've seen since both of those advanced decline lines were in place, our OCO started back about 1990, both AD lines were showing divergences. In this case, that didn't happen. So, you know, we're kind of skeptical about whether or not this is, in fact, a bear market. To a degree, it is a question of semantics. The S&P is down 27%. Does it really matter what you call it? Is it a bear market? Is it a bull market? A correction in a bull market? It's still down 27%, which is a pretty serious hit for anybody. So I guess the question then becomes, would you expect to see the kind of recovery you might get in a traditional bear market? If you think back to, for instance, the 2000-2003 bear market or the 2007-2009 bear market, you had a series of lows, July, October, I believe it was, in 2002 before the final low. In March of 2009, you had October, November lows in 2008, and then the final low in March of 2009, versus, for instance, what some people were calling a bear market in 2018, where you had the low on December 24th, sort of December 26th, the market took off like a rocket, never looked back. So, you know, there perhaps is some importance to differentiating between the two. You know, we're just going to have to wait and see how things play out. That's really about it.
Okay, let me ask you, in the past, including going back to 2018, as you just discussed, when I had you on the program, you have two big important gauges that Lowry's has used successfully for well over seven decades, and that's to measure buying pressure and selling pressure. Richard, when I've had you on the program in the past, you would talk about we are not seeing no increase in selling pressure. What are those two key gauges of yours telling you right now?
This right now, you're seeing a tremendous increase in selling. I don't think that's really a surprise given the intensity of the decline. We've had, I believe, six 90% down days in this decline so far. So we have seen a very substantial rise in selling pressure. What's a little bit surprising is a relatively small drop in buying power, which is our measure of demand. I've looked back at a number of other significant market declines, particularly the decline in the fall of 2008, where there are many parallels between what's happening now and what happened then in terms of the intensity and the extent of the selling. And it's interesting to see there's much more symmetry between the rise in selling pressure and the drop in buying power. This time, it's not even close. Selling pressure has gone up twice as much as buying power has gone down. And that really dates back to, you can take it to the February 19th high. You actually can take it back a little bit longer to late January, when you actually had a peak in buying power and a drop and a low in selling pressure. So that's a little bit of an anomaly, given past significant market declines. But there's no question that you're seeing a tremendous intensity in selling in this decline.
You know what's interesting? You mentioned, you know, when you're seeing this selling, obviously to sell, you have to have somebody on the opposite side of the trade. And I'm just thinking out loud here, Richard, looking at, we've been looking and dissecting the yields on the S&P or the Dow, which, you know, you almost have to go back to 2009 to see anything like this. And right. If you were a pension fund where your mandate is you need to earn a 7.5% return to meet the pension obligations of your retirees, you certainly aren't going to do that in the treasury market right now with yields as low as they are.
Right.
So given this, let's talk about different sectors. We've seen the treasury markets fall. We saw, I think we got down to a little over 0.3% on the 10-year. It's back up on this Friday. What about your advanced decline line of non-operating companies? Last time I talked to you, that line was rising all across, so it was supporting the rise in stocks. Is the advanced decline line supporting the selling pressure and the selling that we're seeing in the market?
Well, this has obviously been a very broad-based decline. You've had a couple days where you've had close to 9-1, or actually maybe a little bit over 9-1, declining issues over advancing issues. So the advanced decline lines really have dropped like a stone. You're probably looking at a little bit faster decline in the operating companies only, because that includes none of the what we call the non-operating company issues, like closed-end funds, preferred stocks, things that are included in the New York All Issues advanced decline lines, which have probably held up a little bit better given the precipitous drop we've had in interest rates over the last couple of weeks. Common stocks only, there has been a very, very sharp drop, which is not surprising given the breadth of this decline.
And Richard, how much of that is also reflecting the amount of money that's in index funds? If somebody is pressing the sell button on their computer to sell their index fund, the fund manager is going to sell everything that is in that index according to the index's weight. They're not going to be saying, well, I don't know if I want to sell this stock, maybe I'll keep this one. They sell the index, period.
Yeah, it's really kind of interesting, because I mentioned the 2008 market decline roughly between about probably late August and to the first week or so in November of 2008. There are tremendous similarities. I just out of curiosity looked to see what the average change was in the S&P daily change in this decline, and when other times that has occurred in the past. The only other time I could find was that period in 2008. Obviously, you had perhaps a little more serious economic conditions then, since we're talking about sort of the collapse of the whole financial system. Right now, there's a lot of uncertainty out there. I don't think anybody's really worried about a collapse as we were looking at potentially in the fall of 2008. Obviously, there are a lot of uncertainties about what the effect this coronavirus is going to have, but it's not quite the same thing. What seems to have changed, and I'm getting to what you're talking about, with the rise in indexing and changes that we've had overall in market structure, with the rise of algorithmic trading, high frequency trading, the proliferation of exchange traded funds, including the index funds like the SPY, they all seem to have added to the volatility of this market. And, you know, when you think this has all occurred, this entire decline has occurred in less than 3 weeks. And, you know, you've just about erased the entire rally from the December 24th low in 2018 in less than 3 weeks. You can look back and see, you know, even the crash in 87, you had been going down for 2 months before you started down. You really didn't start to break down big time until Friday, October 16th. And then, of course, you had the crash on the 19th and the 20th. You know, this has been just from the get-go, from right after the February 19th high, it's been all virtually straight down. You had a little bit of a rally that what appeared to be a selling climax on the February 28th, and a little bit of a rebound rally. But, you know, it's interesting. We've had a couple of 80% up days, and each one of those 80% days was followed the next day by a 90% down day. It's almost as if they just set prices just high enough to re-energize the sellers, and down we go again. So, you know, this has been really, we're calling it unprecedented as far as the intensity and the speed of this decline. We've certainly seen nothing comparable to this in terms of the speed and intensity over our history, you know, back to 1938.
So I want to stick on that for a minute. When you normally, you've looked at 2008, and when you see, as we've seen here in 3 weeks, where virtually the bulk of this decline, really, you know, I wrote a piece a while back called Fast and Furious, and I said because of algo trading, concentration of financials, and also indexing, that when it comes, it'll be fast and furious, which is what this is. When you see this V-shaped decline, which we've seen here over the last 3 weeks, have you looked at what follows? In other words, if we see either a rally, or if your hunch or maybe your suspicions, being skeptical of whether this is a bear market or not, is it followed by a V-shaped recovery as well?
Well, that's sort of the million-dollar question, isn't it? What we're saying is that what you would need to see is sort of an extraordinary series of events that would come close to what we had at the bottom in December 2018. On December 26th, we had a short-term buy signal. We had a conventional, we had an intermediate trend buy signal. We had a 90% up day, all the same day. That was followed on January 4th by another 90% up day, 9-to-1 positive breadth, which, by the way, is extremely rare. And, you know, things like breadth thrusts and the big moves up in our short-term index. It was a veritable 2x4 upside the head, saying this thing is not going to come back down and test the lows. It's going higher. Get on board now while you can. If we were to see something like that, I think we would be on the V camp. If you just see, you know, maybe a little burst of buying, a 90% up day, for instance, not much else behind it, probabilities are that we're going to see a bottom more like, say, in 2011, where you spent a couple of months trying to bottom out, possibly something like 2015, 2016. We had a low in December and then another low, final low in February of 2016. A little bit like 2010, we had another sort of base building period. You had about a two-month period after the January 2018 drop. You didn't bottom out till early April. This is a guess on our part, but I would say that the probabilities are you could see more of a base rather than a V-shaped bottom. But all of it, will depend on what kind of demand develops that would suggest, are you seeing that sort of extraordinary burst of demand, which suggests that prices now are headed directly higher, or is it something going to be more of a base-building process, which could include some brief periods of strong demand, but nothing extraordinary.
The only reason you're talking about probability of a base rather than a V shape. And I think something that would support that is just public psychology and sentiment. I mean, when you see what we've seen, as you just commented, you haven't seen anything this quick, this at this speed of a decline in, you know, your history of following this. And when the public sees something like this, I doubt, and I'm even talking on the institutional side, Richard, how many people are going to be brave enough to say, hey, this is it, I'm going back in, I'm going to be buying?
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously still a level of uncertainty about the market, particularly about the economy. Even if we were to see a dramatic drop in new cases, or if they were to come out with a cure, I think there's still a question of the follow-up effects on the economy. What's it going to have, you know, particularly with the questions about credit, smaller companies going bankrupt, not being able to get credit. There are a lot of questions that would remain to be answered. And I think we all know the market doesn't like uncertainty, and that could act as a dampening effect on any quick rebound from this market drop.
So as an investor, what do you do? Because sometimes, you know, when you're frightened, you're turning on the evening news, and I don't think this coronavirus has played out yet. I think it's going to go exponential, as some of our experts on the program, who are medical experts in today's program. What would you be doing as an investor? Do you sit on the sidelines? And, you know, it's difficult. As you said, if it could be V-shaped, if certain things happen, more likely it's a sort of a bottoming process, as we've seen, as you mentioned, in 2011, 2016. What would you be doing?
I think what you should be doing is, at the very least, making a list of stocks that, you know, have really gotten beaten up, that, you know, probably looked very good back in the middle of February, and, you know, have really have been simply collateral damage in this decline. I mean, nothing's been spared, realistically. So, you know, there obviously are stocks that have dropped that really don't deserve to be trading at the current levels based on their fundamentals and on what their likely fundamentals are going to be over the next quarter, next year. So, you know, I'd be looking for those. And when you get a little bit of a bounce out of the market, such as we're seeing today, you'd probably put a little bit of money to work. And, you know, I think that's just it's going to be a put into stock pickers market. And, you know, I think you try to take advantage of the kind of decline that we've just had.
And if you own those stocks that have fallen, just, I mean, if you're in an index, it doesn't matter what the fundamentals are. If you're 3% of the index, 1.5%, 2% of the index, you're being sold. As things are liquidated,
sure.
You're going down, even though you don't deserve, the fundamentals are good. If you own those, would you just keep them?
Sure, absolutely.
All right. Well, listen, Richard, you guys have been doing this for well over 70 years now. If our listeners would like to follow your work and get in contact with Lowry's, tell them how they could do so, please.
The easiest thing to do is just go online and type in Lowry Research. It's L-O-W-R-Y, no E. And that will take you to our corporate website and give you some background on the company and also show you how you can get a trial subscription to one of our different levels of service.
How long have you guys, you've been doing this since when?
1938 was when Mr. Lowry first published his newsletter.
You've seen just about everything during that period of time. Well, Richard, as always, stay safe. Thanks for coming on the program. All the best and have a great weekend.
Certainly welcome.
Right now, what we're telling clients is that we think that, you know, the price is going to be very volatile for the next 2-3 months. I think given the current economic, medical, political environment, we would not be surprised to see the price spike as high as $1,800 on an intraday basis over the next 3 months.
Well, what a week we've seen this week in the market. Up one day, 1,000 points, down the next day. When will it stabilize? Joining me on the program is Mark Chandler. He's chief strategist at Bannockburn Forex. Mark, let's begin with the volatility. I mean, I haven't seen anything like this in probably a good decade. You'd have to go back to probably 2007 and 2008. So let's begin from the top. What's your take here?
Yeah, so of course, this volatility is killer. And I think that a couple of things that happen. When we buy a stock, the Federal Reserve sets the margin money, how much money we need as a down payment towards that stock. It's 50% right now. You want to buy $100 worth of stock, you got to pay $50 of cash in your broker account. In the markets, like the currency markets, like in equities, equity indexes and capital markets more broadly, you have the margin is tied really not to how much you're buying, not to the value of what you're buying, but tied to how much you could lose in a day. And how much you could lose in a day is a function of volatility. So as volatility has gone up, the margin call, that is, it requires more capital on the part of dealers and banks, commodity trading advisors, hedge funds to take on these positions in the market because the margin requirement to hold these securities that they're buying has gone up sharply. And this includes some of the exchanges like the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. And so this volatility then, just like on the downside, has a self-reinforcing mechanism. And it just strikes me that this is really a Minsky moment. We learned this in the great financial crisis, that a long period of low volatility, rising markets, encourages people to take on all kinds of leverage and all kinds of different ways to take on that more risk. And so for Minsky's words, it'd be like the financial sector, a period of financial stability leads to instability. And so my suggestion for investors is really to remember how he taught us to drive. You don't drive by looking at the pavement right in front of the car. You learn to drive by looking down the road. Aim high in your steering, they say. And that's what I think we're best served today to do, is to remind you to buy value stocks, stocks that you think you can hold on to, for a long period of time, come hell or high water, because both of those are probably coming. And to hold on to those things, value assets, an idea not that they can avoid sell-offs, but they can bounce back quicker.
Let's talk about two kind of shockwaves. If you go back to the beginning of the year, we got a black swan, coronavirus. It's now entering the stage where it just goes parabolic in terms of the number of cases, which is, we had an epidemiologist on the show. He's talking about in the early stage of any kind of virus, whether it's flu, it's sort of starts, you hear a few cases, and now Angela Merkel talk about maybe 60 to 70% of Germans can get it. You've got Italy on lockdown. So there's one shock that's deflationary to hit the economy. It's hitting the airlines, hitting the hotel industry. It's hitting public events. They're canceling events. But the other one, Mark, let's talk about that, which is this suicide mission, this price war between the Saudis and the Russians. I mean, Saudi Arabia needs between $60 to $70 oil to balance their budget. And then on the day you and I are speaking, they're talking about, well, we're going to increase our production to 13 million. So you have a demand shock coming from coronavirus. And now you're going to have a supply shock with Saudi Arabia saying, we're going to produce as much oil as we can.
Yeah, it's not only the Saudis are going to boost output. The Russians, of course, are threatening to boost output, too. They can't boost nearly as much as the Saudis can. The Iraqis, the second biggest producer in OPEC, said they're going to step up output. I think it was Nigeria also. So there is going to be more supply coming on. And that, of course, is going to drive prices. And the market fell to, I think, the April WTI contract fell to about $27, $27.50 earlier this week. And I think you're right, too. When you think about the Saudis, they can stick a straw in the sand and get oil. But how cheap they can get it is really about $3 a barrel. But to your point, what they need to do is cover their fixed costs. And their fixed costs, in this sense, is the government's fiscal policy, which it funds, and a generous welfare state. The one thing I would say for the Saudis that will help them cope with the situation is they have a sovereign wealth fund worth about $500 billion. That's $500 billion. So they can draw down that and help absorb the shock that's coming. And I think this is to your point, too. I mean, you know, the U.S., to get Congress to agree with the president about a fiscal policy in the U.S., they had agreed to sell out of our strategic reserves, and those bids were due today. But instead, they've canceled that. And that means the U.S. government, then, until that auction's held, is going to be short another $500 million. And we were going to sell about 15 million barrels next year. And of course, it depends on the price. I think this is also about the shale producers. We're going to see a lot more mergers, acquisitions, and failures. Their fixed costs, unlike the Saudis or the Russians with the budget and the fiscal promises, the fixed cost for our shale producers is debt. They've got to service their debt. And next month, the banks, it's their annual checkup, like where the bank can basically reset their loan amounts. And so I think that our U.S. shale producers are going to be very much challenged. And this comes at a time when productivity is slipping, when U.S. oil inventories are rising, when the drill count is down. And so I'm concerned that, unlike 2014, the Saudis and the Russians, their lack of agreement or lack of coordination could really pressure the U.S. shale producers, which accounts for a big chunk of U.S. business investment, CapEx.
Well, I know one of the contrasts to the last downturn when the Saudis went all out to produce in 2014, back then, Mark, Wall Street was willing to loan these shale producers money. They could roll over their debt. They could get financing, even though they weren't making money. But the idea they were going to increase their production, that's not the view on Wall Street today. It's like, show us the money before we give you any. So one of the concerns that I have is if you take a look at the lower grade market, almost 25% of it is the energy sector.
Exactly. And I think that, Jim, this is a very important point you raise, is that the last three crises, I know that the folklore is that the Federal Reserve has caused these by raising policy too much. But the last three downturns we've had in the U.S., the great financial crisis, the tech bubble, the savings and loan crisis, these were financial crises that bled over and pushed us into recession. Now what we're having is a real economic shock. Like you say, it's not just on the supply side, like supply chains to produce iPhones has been interrupted. So people in the U.S. are going to struggle to find new iPhones. That's a supply issue. But alongside that, as you mentioned, there's a demand issue going on, a demand shock. Hotels, the whole tourist industry, hospitality industry. And that includes a lot of service sector. You think about the transportations, airlines, credit card use. There's a shock coming to the U.S. economy. And the good news, I'd say, in this is that it looks like before the corona crisis hit, the economic data in the U.S. was fairly strong, suggesting no slowdown, but if anything, maybe a slight acceleration in the January-February period.
So, Mark, when you're taking a look at the ISM service sector that came in very strong at close to 57, you had the February unemployment job numbers, which was great. As you mentioned, we were looking pretty good coming into this. Does this better enable the U.S. to weather this storm, or could we see a mild recession by the time we get to summer?
And that's what you mean by recession. A recession, usually, people use the we in the U.S. officially do not use the two quarters of contraction as our definition of recession. Now, there's a broader definition used. But even if we go with that two quarters of negative growth, I don't know. I mean, I think the it's hard for me to see that. But it, in some ways, it doesn't really matter. I mean, because it could feel like a recession. If we go from, say, roughly, say we were growing 2.75% to maybe even 3% before the crisis hit, and we slow down to almost stagnation, it's going to feel like a recession to people. And that means that unemployment rates are probably going to go up. It means that we should expect and prepare ourselves for that. Things that we should do as just like prudent citizens, boost our cash savings because our jobs might become less secure. It means that it's sort of like the kind of precautionary steps one would take knowing that a storm is coming. It doesn't mean that a storm definitely is coming, but it looks like all things are pointing to a storm. I mean, like you say, Merkel had mentioned that German chancellor just said 60 to 70% of the people in Germany are at risk. And I think that's part of the reason that this volatility in the stock market that we were talking about, it's also affecting the other capital markets, interest rates, currencies. I think it's that the markets act as this incredible aggregator of information. And the problem right now, given these two shocks that we were talking about, the market doesn't know, investors don't know what to focus on, what set of information. And when they think there's a set of information, like fiscal stimulus in the U.S., it gets pulled away from them. And I think that's part of the problem in the U.S. right now, our challenge, is many officials seem to have overpromised and underdelivered. You know, I grew up in Chicago, and one of the events that we had after Richard Daley passed away, Jane Byrne became the mayor. And there was a snowstorm one winter, and according to the citizens of Chicago, she didn't do a good enough job, a quick enough job addressing this public issue. And that ended. And I think that ended her political career. And I think that this is a big challenge, not only for President Trump, but also Chairman Xi in China. Again, this you talk about this being a black swan. I think this is the third or fourth such SARS-like virus coming out of China. I don't know how much of it is a black swan versus it's more like what maybe a folly. We're told from experts that we should expect these things to happen as the world becomes smaller and not everybody has the best practices when it comes to, say, eating food or cleanliness. And we should expect these things. And we are so ill-prepared. And I think that partly that ill-preparedness is what's making sort of taking the rug underneath investors' feet here.
Yeah, because, I mean, you see, you go to Costco, aisles of toilet paper in water are completely barren. You go to Target, it's the same. People walking around buying masks when the people that really need the mask are the healthcare workers that are in the ER or the urgent care center. So it's when irrational thought or even panic takes over the markets or even takes over the populace. Mark, what would you be doing as an investor here? Here's one of the concerns that I see. As we are speaking, we've got the 10-year Treasury below 1%. It's widely anticipated the Fed will be lowering interest rates even further. At least that's what the futures market is telling us at this point. And what are people going to do for income? I mean, when you have 30-year treasuries at a little over 1% and at one time below 1%, what do you do?
Yeah, no, that's a problem. I was just looking at this myself because I was thinking along the same kind of lines as what kind of return can my savings have? And you're not going to get anything. But a lot of us households haven't gotten much from our savings for a while. But I think that if people are looking to boost the rate of return in a conservative fashion, I think that I'd be looking again at those dividend stocks. This big sell-off in U.S. stocks has really one effect of it is to really boost dividends. So if you find a company you like, you've done your homework, it's a quality that you can hold for a long time, I think you pick up, say, 5 to 7% dividends on good name companies right now. And so maybe not be the S&P 50 or the S&P 100, but S&P in the top S&P 500, I imagine you'd be able to find some. And so I think that's important. And also, again, I mean, I haven't done anything. I think that for some people, this is going to be a buying opportunity. It's partly to know when. And, you know, we've had some interesting price action, some technical things that should have indicated, like yesterday we saw the stock market take out the previous day's low and then close above the previous day's high. And that's the kind of reversal pattern that I like to see. But I think that the market right now is so politicized, but that is to say, so influenced by policy coming out.
Yeah, and also, Mark, this is a political election year, so there's going to be finger pointing. You know, the New York Times called it the Trump virus. You've got both sides pointing the fingers at each other. And maybe that's another thing that makes the market nervous, because from what we're seeing, as the cases begin to escalate and go exponential, you want to see some kind of unity or some kind of positiveness. You know, I think back, and you can remember this, back to 1987, the day the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 23% in a single session. Ronald Reagan came out and said, the economy's strong, we're going to be okay, we'll get through this, and things look good. People believed him, and the market recovered. I don't know what to believe coming out of Washington today.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the problem. I mean, that's what I partly mean by not knowing how to be prepared, like materially and infrastructure, but I think we've wasted a lot of our goodwill and our capital when it comes to these things. What strikes me is earlier today, March 11th, the Bank of England cut interest rates by 50 basis points about a week before their policy meeting. And a few hours later, the Treasury Department, really the Chancellor of the Exchequer, provided a stimulative fiscal policy. This is a parliamentary system. It's unlike our presidential congressional system. But here is an example about a central bank and fiscal authorities working together and making it clear, sending out a positive signal. It turns out that after they cut rates by surprise, and I mean by surprise, most people were not expecting it, or even if there was like a chance it could happen, it was seen to be after the budget. This was several hours before the budget, before the UK markets opened. And sterling initially dipped, but then rallied.
So as you look at this right now, I think you and I are in both agreement. If you have a chance to pick up some good dividend paying stocks, know the story behind the company, because, you know, I tell this story, Mark, going back to the 2007 and 2009 financial crisis. Had you owned, you know, quality stocks like a Coca-Cola or an IBM, the stocks went down, but through the entire crisis, they increased their dividend every single year. So at least you were getting cash flow. That cash flow was increasing. And when you're looking at interest rates today that could be heading to zero, this might look good in the future. Mark, as we close, if our listeners like to follow the work that you do, tell them how they could do so.
Sure. Thanks, Jim. So my work, I have a blog called Mark to Market. Now that's Mark with a C. I'm on marktomarket.com. I have something out there 6 days a week, sometimes more than one piece. Also, I'm on Twitter. My handle there is Mark Making Sense, which is the title of my first book, Making Sense of the Dollar. My second book, Political Economy of Tomorrow, tries to understand where we're going post-crisis. And I think it's very timely in light of the economic nationalism and what's going on with the dollar.
All right. Well, listen, as always, Mark, pleasure having you on the program. All the best. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. Good luck to everybody.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.